There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine, to start with, is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to our 60th podcast, June 2012. On this program, we feature another woman winemaker, Sarah Fowler, winemaker at Peju Winery in Rutherford, California.
Many times over the past few years, we have interviewed women winemakers in Napa Valley with the concern of educating wine lovers as to just whom is making the wine they love. This time we talked to Sarah Fowler, winemaker at Peju, which is located in Rutherford, home to the famous Rutherford Dust. Winemaking is a demanding art, and with a family including two kids, Sarah has managed to make it all work for a very long time. We met with Sarah at Peju Winery during the week of Premier Napa Valley. You can also hear a brief interview with her at the barrel tasting from podcast number 54, part 2. So I'm here at Peju Winery with the winemaker, Sarah Fowler. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much for taking the time to meet with us. I know you were a little under the weather earlier in the week.
Yeah.
But you look great, so you've made a good
Thanks.
Comeback.
Working on it. On the road to recovery.
Yes. So we're here during Premier Week, and there's going to be a lot going on. Are you going to be involved with Premier
Absolutely.
Yourself? What are you going to be doing?
We will be, what am I not doing? We will be having a party here for the Rutherford Dust Society here at Peju. We will be pouring our Premier lot, but we're also doing, it's past, present, and future. So we'll be doing something from the past, our present, and then sell a little future sneak peek here. And we're doing, it's all the different wineries from the area getting together at Peju to pour. It's going to be fun. We've got a James Bond theme going on.
Ooh, I like
and
that.
Yeah, it's it takes the thief, and our premier lot is called Wine Thief Sapage.
Ooh, mm-hmm. That sounds like fun.
A little spiel about me stealing around the cellar and pulling samples together for my blend. And then I will be doing a prospective tasting for the Napa Valley Vintners, and they went ahead. I participated at earlier, a couple of months ago, and this is kind of the review of the final. So we'd gone through and tasted it. Anyone in the Valley could submit Cabernet Sauvignons and Merlots to this. I was part of the panel to go through, and everything was blind, and we went through and selected the best, turned it in. We don't know what wines were selected, and so this Friday, there'll be a prospective tasting, and I believe it's held at the CIA, and you're going to that as well.
It's at the Red Center, right?
Okay, yeah,
right.
And go through and tasting that again. And our Merlot was picked this year
excellent.
As one of the prospective. And so out of all the Merlots that were sent in, only 8 made it. So
wow.
I'll be tasting that. And then on Friday afternoon, we're doing the tasting here. Saturday is premiere. I'm going ahead earlier for the St. Helena Star. And I'll be doing, every year we kind of split up a certain amount. There's a group, a panel of us. We'll go through and we'll rate our premiere section. So I think right. I've got 20 wines to go through and taste. Mm-hmm. Rate, send it in, pick a favorite, and there's various, like, it's not just the favorite wine, but who has the best story and compelling and et cetera. It's a fun thing. So, yeah, premiere. And then there's all the little parties. Going to a competitor's party Friday night.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you
going to
be wearing dark glasses? It'll be fun.
No. There's lots of great events that happen during premiere, so it's one of my favorite times of the year. So, this cold got to go away because I've got some playing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't hear it in your voice, so that's a good thing.
Oh, that's good.
I agree. Premier Week is an exciting week because there's so much going on. Certainly for us when we come into town to be able to enjoy all the parties and try all these wines and certainly meet all these people, it just makes it a great place to be. So, Sarah, let's talk about you and your life and wine. You know, I always ask people this, and maybe everybody seems to have that moment. Was there a moment where you just, the switch got flipped and you went, wow.
This is what I want to do?
In terms of, well, first in wine, and then this is what I want to do.
Well, for me, the first thing, my first job ever was working at a winery. I was about 15 and a half, technically 16 on paper. I worked on a mobile bottling line for a large producer. I don't know if I should say that out loud, who I worked for.
You're welcome.
Okay, I worked at Kendall Jackson back when Jed Steele was still making wine.
I think I've heard
there.
Of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're you know, they're well known.
Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you know. And had worked there off and on through high school. And then when I was going away to college and coming back home, I would work various things. So did everything from the bottling line when I was younger to helping out in the lab and then eventually working harvest a couple of times. That's when I did all the, you know, made tanks overflow and got to my plate. Yeah, all the stuff that winemakers never want to have happen, mm-hmm. happened during that trial. And at that point, I wasn't really sure that I wanted to go into winemaking. I'd made beer with my dad, loved to cook, and had dropped out of college, moved to Mexico, lived on a sailboat for a year, and, you know, eventually ran out of money, came back, and had worked another harvest at Kendall Jackson. And that's kind of where it clicked for me. I was like, I really loved the lifestyle. I really loved wine. I mean, I was the kid in high school who, you know, brought wine every day after work. I don't think they do this anymore, but they used to give us bottles of wine. I'm probably getting someone in trouble. But they used to give us wine. And so when I graduated from high school, I had like a pallet of wine. And so for parties, I brought wine to the parties.
Maybe to a degree you didn't have the whole hang-up about alcohol as you got into your high school years, or maybe you did.
No.
It was just something that you were used to. It wasn't sort of like, let's sneak this under our coats.
You know, it's true. I had friends that really wanted to sneak it and went big at parties. And for me, because we were allowed to drink it at home and I was around it and my dad and I made beer together all through high school. So it was something to appreciate. I understood it from a different kind of perspective. And I thought it was fascinating. I mean, even at an early age, I mean, I loved the food and wine. I loved the abilities to make all different types of flavors come from the different grapes, whether it was, and with beer too. Just, I really enjoyed kind of the science, creativity, artistic meld that it came together. So for me, it did happen early, and I've always enjoyed it. I mean, of course I'm going to end up making wine.
It was a logical progression.
Absolutely.
That's what it sounds like. Are you a native of this area? Are you from California, I'm guessing, you are originally?
Yes. My children are six generations. We have a 400-acre organic ranch up in Lake County, and we have grapes up there. Now Zinfandel and Syrah, pears, apples. So I grape up. I'm a farm girl.
I guess that's what you have to do to be a winemaker. Something people don't always understand.
Right.
Winemakers are farmers.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's absolutely what we are.
So how did you end up making beer with your dad? I'm kind of curious. It wasn't sort of like you're sitting at the breakfast table one day and dad said, hey, honey, let's make some beer.
So growing up on a farm, we had access to all sorts of, I mean, we, you know, had our garden was like an acre in size. My dad liked to, you know, we were always planting different things. We had pear. We started off taking our pears to St. George Spirits and having it turned into pear brandy and pear liqueur. My dad made organic apple juice and sold it at the farmer market. And this is, you know, going back, you know, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but it's going back in some time where people weren't always, that was new. And he was on the board of directors for CCOF, which is California Certified Organic Farming. And so playing and making and creating was kind of something my family did. And so whether it was homemade apple juice or turning our pears into alcohol, so it was kind of pretty much sitting at the kitchen table saying, you know, how about let's make some beer. All right, that sounds like a great idea. And we were both bookworms. I grew up without a TV, so I read a lot. And basically we went down to, the first time we ever did it was go down to, I might say local. We actually had to go out of our county because there wasn't any beer supplies. But go picked up some beer supplies and made it, you know, very simply. And then progressively got, you know, made more and more. And then my dad at some point ended up going and buying a brewery and actually doing it more on a larger level. So But it took, you know, that was from day one to like 10 years later. So it was something that we just, you know, he likes to cook. I like to cook.
Obviously, your dad's a big influence on you, which I think is classic father-daughter relationship. Do you mind if I ask the name of the brewery?
Soda Bay Brewing Company was the name of the brewery at the time. And it's no longer. Oh, okay. It lasted for a short period of time. And there's all sorts of other things that occurred.
Well,
his health went downhill. And
I'm assuming your dad's still with us.
He is. Good. But
good. Sounds like an
interesting... Down in Costa Rica.
No. Well, what a rough life he's got. But I think that's great. And there's an old saying, I'm sure you're very well aware of it, is that it takes a lot of beer to make good wine.
It's true.
Yeah. So you have that background. And after you moved on, you know, off to your own life, I guess, without your family, did you ever dabble in beer again at all? Or?
You know, So not really. I have lots of friends that make beer and make it at home. And for me, because I had done it early on, when I reflect on it, I was really slave labor. I did all the cleaning and sanitizing and the hard work. And now I just like to drink beer and I really enjoy it, but I'm not really interested in doing all the sanitation, all the hard work it does to make beer at home or even wine at home. I'd much rather do it on a larger production.
I can't think of too many winemakers I know that are making wine at home, although I did meet one just the other day. My point being is that, I mean, I was mentioning Jean before and Sam Baker up at Terra Valentine and you and Pam Starr and, you know, all you guys are very, very independent spirits. If there is a common thread you all have, it's that, and none of you are alike.
Right.
Other than with that idea of doing this and doing your own thing.
I mean, in general, we all like food, we like wine, we like to travel. I mean, there's... you know, definitely some real specific things that I think that anybody who really goes into winemaking, there's certain things that they have, and those three are event across the board. Very, usually, very warm, friendly, nice. I mean, not pretentious. I mean, they're great people. I love all the winemakers that I know in the Valley. I mean, and I'm fairly social, and there's a lot of great, amazing people, strong, smart, interesting.
I would agree with you. Do you think maybe a little bit of that because it is the farmer thing? I mean, not all of them are farmers, but majority of them are.
Because it could be. Salt of the earth.
Yeah.
Probably. I'm very humble. I mean, it's, I like where you're going with that.
I also think, too, what I get is a common thread to family. There's a lot, I mean, we're talking about your dad, and I hear that a lot. Very strong connection to the family. It doesn't matter, dad or mom, but it seems to be a big deal, which is part of the farming lifestyle.
I think that's true, and it's nice. I mean, when you say that, it makes me reflect back on, I have a son who wants to go to culinary school. I mean, he's 16 and wants to, I mean, that's, and he loves, I mean, he's been cooking since, I mean, and actively cooking since he's been 9 and cooks in town, you know, I mean, so he loves that. And I have a son that's contemplating fermentation science. And so,
really?
You know,
he's
18. I mean, he just worked harvest here this past year and it's fantastic. And he actually is contemplating maybe going into the brewing industry instead of winemaking. I'm kind of, you know, hoping that he goes into winemaking. But brewing's fine, too. I mean, they're both good.
You never know. You might see the light one day, though, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I've met a lot, just like you doing it, there are a lot of professionals that, not working with the parents, but doing it professionally, that ended up going into wine. And I think that's neat, the idea, you know, your sons have sort of got this connection. But it's the same thing. It's the family thing, right?
It is true. I mean, I looking at it from a very healthy perspective, good. If my kids ever listen to this, good. You guys hear this? Follow in mommy's footsteps.
There you go, exactly. Now go to bed.
Yeah.
You're too old for that, I guess, now. If I can ask this question, is your husband related to the business?
No.
Okay.
He's not. He is an optometrist.
Okay. Just curious, because sometimes people are, and just like that, there's a completely different business.
When you say that, it's funny, because 2 years ago, I lost my oenologist right before harvest, and my husband has, his undergrad is in biochemistry. And, you know, as a eye doctor, he has lots of science. And so he came in, and within a couple of days, was able to run all my lab equipment, and actually became my interim oenologist for a short period of time, and loved it. I had a hard time actually weaning him away from working in the lab. So where he's, you know, not in the industry, but he understands it and, you know, can do the chemistry aspect of it.
Do you think there's maybe a little underlying thing there that he's kind of like,
Oh, he'd love to have my job, because he's not allowed to, you know, have wine at lunch. And where I can. And
that would be bad. I wouldn't want my optometrist having a glass or two of wine.
Yeah.
I would certainly enjoy you having one. So, yes, I get it.
He's a little jealous.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can't. Yeah. It just works this way. It's better.
As she says, looking out, it's better. I want to talk about women in wine. Not a lot of people are aware that there are women winemakers. And truthfully, you know, I'm not trying to make it an issue because as I see it, it's not. But the key here is that it's, number one, it's a very physically demanding job. And the simple fact that you grew up in a farm, I imagine you've already got that in your head. But it's, many women in wine have said to me, it is. So it's a business dominated by men. How do you see it?
I'm going to say that it's still dominated by men. I mean, when you look at the numbers and people have been doing, you know, there's someone who just recently in the last maybe 6 months came out with a survey and did women winemakers and kind of did a percentage on how many. And in per, you know, whether it's each state and then each individual area, so Napa versus Sonoma. And the overall percentage was something like 7%. And so we're still, there's not very many of us. But I'm going to say that there's more and more of us. And I see more and more assistant winemakers coming in and being winemakers. Going to school, you know, there was maybe 70 of us in our program and only that four that graduated. And of those four, two of us are still actively involved in winemaking, and that was just for that specific year. So, I mean, a lot's changed and, you know, I mean, been doing it for a while. And so I do see more and more women coming up, and I think that's fantastic. I think when it comes to physical activity, you know what, we're smart. And if something is physically demanding, too physically, we know where to find a boy to help us, you know, roll a barrel around, you know, we can, it's, I think we're over that point where we have to prove that we have to go out there and drag every hose and do that. I mean, you absolutely have to do that. And so in winemaking, in the beginning, when you're first starting off and you have to work in the cellar, absolutely. And you have to be able to do that, you know, for X amount of time. But then probably by the time you actually become a winemaker, that becomes less and less. Not that you don't spend any time in the cellar, but you're not doing as much hose dragging as you are a lot of the other things that you need to do.
You are no longer a cellar rat.
I'm no longer, during harvest I might still be a cellar rat, but the rest of the year, not so much.
To be a winemaker, being smart's a given. I mean, this is a complicated job. You have to predict the future. You have to be able to understand how things are going to go together. You're managing people. Above all else, Mother Nature is breathing down your neck every day of the week.
Yes, and the last couple of years have been proof to that.
There's a certain amount of stress involved and obviously pressure because you do have to produce. You are responsible for people. You're responsible for product.
Correct. So, I mean, we can't control Mother Nature and as much as we would like to. I mean, we certainly have techniques and tools in our belt that will help us if a harvest is later or it comes earlier or different things. But really it's all about farming and growing the grapes. I mean, we cannot make phenomenal wine from grapes that aren't phenomenal. Equally, I mean, the base is from the grapes that we grow. And I don't care who you talk to. You can be the best winemaker in the entire world. If you do not have good grapes, you will not make good wine. And so, you know, we can mess that up. And, you know, we can take phenomenal grapes and make mediocre wine. That would make us not very good winemakers. I mean, but controlling all the things, I mean, really what makes winemaking so interesting and fascinating is that every single year, I just did my 18th harvest this past year. And every single year it's been different. I mean, there's not a single time that it's been the same. I mean, there are things that are similar every year, but it is completely different. I mean, it's, you've got all these different factors. So it's almost like learning and making something brand new every single time. And that's, I mean, that's a, it's complex and satisfying and rewarding, and hopefully at the end we're producing something that we can send out and have, you know, hundreds of, not thousands and thousands of people enjoy.
And you're not making cookie cutter wines, that's the bottom line too, right?
No, that would be undesirable in my opinion.
There you go. And that's what it should be with a winemaker. So how many cases are you doing here, Keisha?
We're making 28,000. We've been making 28,000 for a while. I think our website says 35,000 only because no one's actually gone through and changed it. We did hit that mark once in 2005. It was a very big harvest for us, and then we've gone back down. I think our goal is to make around 30, maybe even 40. We're in the process of planting some new vineyards. We purchased another vineyard not too long ago. So we've got three different properties here at Peju. We've got the property right here in Rutherford, which is certified organic. We have a property in Calistoga that's organic as well. We're getting the certification in the next couple of months.
Okay.
It's a brand new vineyard, so this, we just got started getting the fruit. And we have a Persephone vineyard, which is up in Pope Valley, so that's the north east portion of the valley, and we're going to plant some more vines up there. So we're growing. You know, it's we're having a hard time keeping up. We keep running out of certain wines, which is fantastic. The thing about Peugeot is last year we bottled 20 different wines, and only four are out in distribution.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
That is a big difference. Yeah. So most of it is sold here at the winery or through our wine club, and then just four core ones out in distribution.
Do you have a ceiling, though, you want to keep it at? I mean, when you said 35,000, you know, is it a point that, obviously you're not the owner, but will you want to keep it to where it's not getting unmanageable?
So, and I've worked at large wineries before, and I'm comfortable with that. But my preference, so you're right, I'm not the owner. And so my preferences wouldn't necessarily match, you know, what ownership wants. And we've got, you know, second generation coming in and making new wines. And for myself, though, I mean, I kind of like where we are. I think we have the capacity and capability to go keep quality up, and we could probably go 40. To me, I wouldn't want to go any more than 50. Like, personally, for our brands, I mean, I really like kind of in that, you know, maybe the 30 to 50 and maybe even 40. It's just I can be really involved, actively involved at that point. Once you get bigger than that, I start, you know, it's it'll be a little bit less hands-on. And I don't necessarily want to lose that. I like that connection.
Okay. We were talking off mic about the idea of cooperation here in the Valley. So you do share information between you and other winemakers, right?
I mean, oh, absolutely. We do. Yeah, we. If I have an issue or if one of my colleagues have an issue, we are very comfortable picking up the phone or getting together to share a glass of wine and reviewing what we're working on and maybe what the issue is. And in fact, we get together not only personally, but there's groups to get together. I mean, the Napa Valley Vintners have put together a group of panels of winemaking, and we get together on a regular basis and we discuss issues and just hot topics. And there's always a new hot topic. There's several different organizations, and we get together on a regular basis. And I love the ability to be able to pick up the phone or have somebody, hey, are you swinging by? I want to come by and taste by. You know, I'm putting on this new blend. I'm excited about it. What do you think? And, you know, and sometimes they're like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. And sometimes like, yeah, you know, I might do X, Y, and Z, and you take that all in. And, you know, it's not necessarily collaborative, but it's it can be a shared experience.
Another opinion never hurts.
Right.
Yeah. Do you belong to any kind of a tasting group yourself?
I do. So my most active tasting group is my Bubbles tasting group. And I am a huge, huge, huge fan of Bubbles, champagne specifically, but I like all things sparkling. And it's a bunch of different winemakers in the Valley, and we get together and we taste Bubbles, you know, Epernay or Rennes, or we'll do Blanc de Blancs or Blanc de Noirs, and vintage, you name it, we get together on a regular basis. And maybe it's because one of us makes Bubbles, and we get together and we taste, and it's blind, and it's amazing, and it's perfect.
But how many people are in that group?
There's eight of us. And once in a while, we will invite a few other people to get to about 12. And we travel together at this point.
Oh,
we
nice. Are,
yeah, so we love everything. Yeah, love Bubbles.
Are they all winemakers?
All winemakers. And we do have two coopers.
Mm-hmm. That would be a blast to be a fly on the wall and watch you guys go through this process, because what you could learn in your own kind of personal vernacular between each other.
You'd be surprised on... Yeah, you'd be surprised, because where we're maybe in a tasting group, certain tasting groups are very formal. This is not formal. and we enjoy the heck out of it. But it's learning. But it's fun and informative.
The best thing is you're taking something that you do for a living, and you're still letting that passion survive by doing it outside of doing it for a living.
Yes, and I look forward to every single time we get together.
How often do you get together?
We try to get together once a month.
That's great, and that's not easy when you're a mom of two and you got a marriage, and this is obviously a demanding job.
Right, but this is, you know, I have priorities. Just sorry, family, work.
Off mic, you were telling me that you have a barrel experiment.
I do.
What is that?
So I, every year, put together an experiment of barrels that I'm using, currently using, and then barrels that maybe I'd like to try. And I typically have 50 plus. This, 2011, I have about 54 different barrels in my barrel experiment. I leave the wine, so I put together a rather large blend. It's one wine. I use the same wine. I put it in these barrels. The wine never gets racked. It stays in the barrels from the moment it goes in until I rack it out at the end. And I also put some of the wine into neutral barrels. And so when I top, I use neutral, the same wine from the neutral oak to top every single one of them. I do two barrels of each barrel type in the experiment. So that way, what I'm doing is really going in and tasting the real specific of that one type of barrel, the same wine, topped with the same wine, and it's never been racked, mixed, nothing. So it's unusual because I don't know anybody else is doing it to that same level in the valley. And so I have winemakers from up and down the valley that love coming, and coopers that like coming to taste this wine. I also leave the wine. I don't actually start tasting the barrel experiment until it's been in barrel for over a year. Because barrels that, if the wine goes into the barrel for 6 months, that's not my program. And sometimes the barrels taste amazing at 6 months, and after a year, year and a half, they don't taste so good. So for me, I won't start tasting it until it's over a year. And our own barrel program for our Napa Valley tier, which this wine would go into, the wine stays in barrel for 16 to 18 months, typically 18. Mm-hmm. And so we'll start tasting it a little over a year, up until 18, and we taste them blind over and over again. And it's amazing how different all the different barrel types. So 54 barrel types all have a different, distinct flavor profile. And I love going in there and tasting and seeing if, you know, one, if I'm consistent, because I'm tasting blind.
Yeah.
I like doing American versus French, and then I also like combining it to see, you know, what the differences are. And I've been doing a barrel experiments like this for over 10 years, and I love watching the progression of seeing how the American oak barrel has been improving because of just really the focus that coopers are doing on the toasting level and the treatment of the barrels and the oak, treating it more like a French oak barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And watching how just over time, how you can just see how much the improvements. And there's some American oak barrels that are just as delicious, if not more delicious, than some French oak barrels. So that's been fascinating.
Where does the wine go? Is it a club issue? Is it, you know?
So the wine club idea is a good one, and we may have to steal that. But right now, I use a Cabernet Sauvignon. We make more Cab than any other varietal. And the wine from my barrel experiment goes into my Napa Valley Cab.
Oh, okay. Great, great. If you steal the idea, you just have to deliver a barrel to my house.
Okay, that's there awesome. You go.
Yeah, that's a lot of wine.
It is a lot of wine. Sometimes I don't understand why I do the things I do, but, you know.
A winemaker is part scientist, and usually mad scientist, and artist.
Correct. And so sometimes you need that creative license to go and do the things that you know inside is the right thing to do. And for me, the barrel experiment is the right thing to do. It doesn't cost us any more money. It's not really. It takes us a little bit more time, maybe, but it is. It's the right thing to do.
That's a good answer. Sarah, for our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you or about Peju here in Napa Valley, how would they find out about you?
The easiest way would be to either come by and visit us here in Rutherford in the Napa Valley, or find us on our website, www.peju.com.
Great, excellent. I really appreciate you taking the time to meet with me during Premier Week, and I hope we get to meet again.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Learn more by visiting peju.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Watch for our next program, which is a special coming to you direct from Auction Napa Valley 2012. Life Between the Vines was produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and our intern, Bob Warner. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.